you were trying to segue, and I stopped you, into another energy matter. We talked about...
You sent me right down the oil well, not the rabbit hole of the oil well. Yeah.
So there's another energy issue. We talked about it last time, but it didn't look like there was going to be an agreement. Since we had our last episode, there's now been an agreement between Israel and Lebanon, brokered by the United States, to resolve a territorial dispute, a maritime territorial dispute between these Lebanon and Israel that had some implications on the natural gas production in the Eastern Med. And in short, and I encourage people to, we have to look at a map, which we can't do, of course, on a podcast, but there's basically, basically two main lines of dispute. Lebanon wanted the maritime line to be more south, obviously. Israel had asked for, had wanted it more north. There's been talks for years about this. They had an agreement where Israel agreed to the original Lebanese demand, which is further south, that does allow Israel control of this Karish natural gas field, but goes through another natural gas field called Qana. There's a recognition of a 5-kilometer extended line that's called like the buoy line. It's, I think, it's a series of buoys in the water that the Israeli security forces were particularly keen on. So while it's not a formal recognition, it's some recognition of the status quo. But basically, and we mentioned this last time, there is now an agreement that Israel has completely agreed to the Lebanese demand completely. There have been some economic things where Israel will get, I think, a portion of any natural gas that's produced out of this Qana field. It will enable Israel to really get a natural gas up from this Karish field, which supposedly will go to Europe, which is positive given the Ukraine situation. But it's become a political issue in Israel. It is not, there's no Knesset vote of approval, like we talked about this last time. And I guess one last thing, and then it seems like the security forces in Israel, the Mossad, the IDF, they support this by the reports. But there have been concerns that given Israel's capitulation to the Lebanese demand, that Hezbollah will see this as Israel being fearful of a conflict, and it could embolden Hezbollah. So that's how I see the setup. Ron,
Yeah, that's a big chunk there that we're going to try to take the pieces out. But so first, it is true that all the security, the senior heads of all the relevant security services in Israel, the military, the chief of staff, head of military intelligence, also the head of the Shabak, the head of the Mossad, they all apparently supported this. That in itself is not dispositive for me. I mean, it's a serious thing when everyone is of the same view. You know, a lot of people in Israel say that when everyone's of the same view, we should be worried because we had a problem, particularly before the Yom Kippur War, that everyone had the same view and they didn't see what they should have seen at the time. But also in recent history in Israel, the security services, which I rely on a lot of things, and certainly everything tactical and in defending the country and all that. But this is really a diplomatic issue and how diplomacy could ultimately affect your security. It's a very different dynamic than saying, well, here are soldiers and here are commanders and here are security experts who tell you how to conquer a piece of territory, what the impact of you doing this thing for security, how it will affect another front, how are we going to defend ourselves? This is an assessment of what a particular deal you're going to make in diplomacy, how will it affect your overall security? And here, you know, the track record, recent track record is not good. You saw that with the disengagement, where all the heads of the security effectively supported the disengagement and said it was going to actually make Israel more secure. Didn't happen.
Wait,
you saw
disengagement from?
Disengagement from Gaza, the withdrawal from Gaza.
Oh. 2005.
Now, the security services can say, look, if you withdraw from Gaza, this is going to be the consequences, A, B, C, and D, and this is how we're going to have to defend ourselves. But they went well beyond there, and they said, look, this is going to make Israel safer, and this is going to make... And the same thing happened with Oslo. So for a lot of the Israeli public, they look with skepticism at the security services' views on a lot of these matters, and also because a lot of the heads of the security services ultimately go into politics. I think that is affected because there was a period of time where they didn't. I think the last four or five chiefs of staff have all gone into politics. So a lot of people will see it as more of a political view of what should be done rather than a national security point of view. Now, I do not understand why this is good for Israel's national security. Now, I wasn't in those intelligence briefings, so maybe there are things here I haven't seen. But it is not, A, it's not dispositive for me that the security officials believe that. But beyond that, I'm very concerned that the view in the region and the view in Lebanon and the view of Hezbollah itself is that Israel was not prepared to go to a war, was not prepared to fight. Because the way that they sold this to the public and the way that all these officials said, essentially, it's this deal or war.
Where have we heard that before?
And I heard that even from a relatively senior U.S. official. You know, we're trying to prevent a war. He told me, like, this is why this is a good deal, because we're trying to prevent a war. I said, with that kind of attitude, we never would have had a country. Because every time they threatened Israel go to war, what are we supposed to make a compromise? What I can't for the life of me understand is what Israel got in this deal. I read the agreement. It's like a six-page agreement. I read it. I do not see what Israel said. What I thought that Israel was going to get is the recognition of its maritime border. Now, you use that word recognition. I want to use recognition. You know, we had a 1949 armistice line. That was the status quo. Did that mean that the Arab states gave us recognition? Did Egypt give us recognition? Did Syria give us recognition? Did Lebanon? No, they said no recognition. Even after the Six-Day War, they fought wars to reverse the 1948-49 war. But then they attacked us. That line was not a line of defense. Internationally, it was recognized as such, as kind of the boundaries, the minimal, let's say, the boundaries of Israel and the other areas being more in dispute. But I don't call it a line of recognition. It's a status quo. And what the agreement actually says is that this issue will be resolved when we resolve the land border issue. Now, here's the problem with that. Israel withdrew from Lebanon, supposedly to the international boundary.
In 2000.
And Hezbollah did not accept that status quo international boundary. So what we've done now is we've linked the land border with the maritime border, and we've given now an argument to Hezbollah in the future to say, wait a second, I don't recognize this maritime border. I said that when we resolve the land border dispute, then we'll also resolve this dispute. So I don't think Israel got recognition. And it seems to me that we fully gave up our economic rights to this area. Now, people may think, you know what, given the size of Israel's economy, this additional gas that you're giving to Lebanon, it's not such a big deal. And they may think it is in the interest of Israel to do this deal in order to not have the Lebanon economy totally collapse and not have a Somalia-like situation on Israel's northern border. You know, that's an argument. But to say that it makes Israel safer because it prevents a war, I'm very concerned when I see that kind of rhetoric. Because when I see let me tell you this, I was aware of the negotiations that had gone on for several years, and we spoke about it in the last podcast, for the last 10 years. It seems to me that this deal could have been done years ago if you just would have surrendered your old position and just moved the line to wherever Lebanon wants. The fact that our gas field is in our territory was not a matter of dispute. That was a Hezbollah all of a sudden decided, no, you know, we don't just have a minor border disagreement with you in the north. Now we want Haifa to be part of Lebanon. Now we want Tel Aviv to be part of Lebanon. And now all of a sudden we're going to make a deal where Tel Aviv and Haifa are not part of Lebanon, and we're going to pat ourselves on the back. I mean, it's a bit ridiculous. So what I see is what happened here were three things that worked together to create this deal. One of them was the Lebanese economy collapsed. And in 2020, you had that massive explosion in Lebanon. The whole thing was in disarray. And even despite this collapse, Israel, when I was there, I remember working with Netanyahu as ambassador in Washington. I remember we were always telling the U.S. administration to not simply give a blank check to Lebanon to rebuild their economy, to link the issue of support for Lebanon, whether it comes from the IMF, whether it goes from the French, or whether it comes to the United States, to link that support to a change so that it would weaken Hezbollah eternally. It wasn't just, let's throw money to Lebanon economy so it doesn't collapse. So all of a sudden, Lebanon's economy does collapse, and Hezbollah is under tremendous pressure. That, from my point of view, means their negotiating position has effectively collapsed against Israel, okay? And then you have another issue where Hezbollah sees that a deal might be happening between Israel and Lebanon, that Israel is prepared to make these concessions, and then they start threatening Israel. They start threatening our gas field. And so now it puts Israel in a position that it's going to look like, and here, you know, deterrence is about appearances. It's less about reality. I mean, to prevent war, you have to convince the other side that you're strong and you're willing to fight. And here, it looks like those Hezbollah threats shifted Israel into a different position and now made it more willing to do this deal. And then you have the United States putting pressure on Israel to do this deal, or the French thinking that this is a good deal because Total is partly owned by the French government. They want to see this gas. What I'm seeing right here is that Israel basically gave up in these negotiations. The line is not recognized, as far as I'm concerned. It's only a status quo. We've given up territorial waters. In the beginning, it was said we did not give up territorial waters. We did. It's a very small section, and people can mock it and say it's a bunch of jellyfish that are out there. So and fish is what you gave up, but we gave up territorial waters, and the economic waters. We just shifted the entire line south to give all the benefits to Hezbollah. I mean, all the benefits to Lebanon, excuse me. And then the prime minister, Lapid, he went when he announced this deal, he said Israel was going to get 17%. Now, this 17% number is not in the agreement. It doesn't exist. It's supposedly what's going to be negotiated with Total at some point in the future, and it'll negotiate before they start drilling. I don't know. I've been involved in negotiations for many years. I've never seen something like this. Given where we were and where we are now, I do not see it. If the argument of our security officials, and there may be something there that I don't know, I want to put that out there because sometimes you never know. I'll give you an example for our listeners to know something. And I don't know if we've ever discussed this on the podcast, but I remember years ago, I was economic attaché in Washington. It's 2007. And I walked into APAC's big dinner that they had in 2000. It was in March 2007. And they have their annual dinner, you know, the big dinner where they have half the Congress.
Biggest kosher dinner in the world, I think.
Right? Biggest kosher dinner in the world, yeah. And at that point, they had, you know, a few thousand people. It grew over the next decade. But then it was several thousand people and well over half of Congress. And Olmert appeared by satellite from Israel. Ehud Olmert was the prime minister, okay? And he appears. And what he says in his speech, he praises George W. Bush for the surge in Iraq. And I was kind of stunned by that. And the reason I was stunned is that in November 2006, you had midterms. The Democrats retook the House after 12 years of being in Republican hands. And the main issue in the election in 2006 was the war in Iraq. The Democrats were against the war in Iraq. And then Bush, instead of simply folding his tent, decided, and I think he showed tremendous leadership, regardless of what you think about the actual policy, but he certainly went against the current. He decided he's going to do a surge. And here Olmert was just praising Bush for his decision. Now, Pelosi and all the Democratic leadership are in the room listening to this. And I was thinking to myself, wow, what is this guy doing? Does he not understand what happened in the United States? Is there nobody on his staff who is telling him that this is really to slap all the Democrats in the face? I couldn't believe it. I thought it was an act of recklessness. And then 2 months later, there was an attack on the nuclear facility in Syria. And you realize that what happened was that the White House was looking for support of their surge policy. Israel was trying to get the White House to, if not do the attack in Syria, to bomb it themselves, but certainly to give a green light to Israel to bomb the nuclear facilities there. And it was a small price for Prime Minister Olmert to pay to praise Bush's surge policy in order to get more goodwill from the U.S. administration. So he actually made the right decision for the security of the country. Now, when I was watching this, I didn't see that. So when there is something that happens that makes zero sense to me, A lot of times it has to do with another issue that is not on the radar screen. Now, what makes me skeptical that that's the case now is that it's also happening a couple weeks before an election. So I don't really know what the story is. What I see in front of me is certainly not a good deal for Israel. It projects weakness. I think there's huge procedural problems here where a government on the eve of an election is trying to rush this through and does not even allow the Knesset to vote on this. And especially because they gave back territorial waters, there should be a vote. There's a lot of other sub issues. But the big issue for me is, does this advance Israel's security or does it weaken Israel's security? And the way I see it, we had a great hand to play vis-a-vis Hezbollah, vis-a-vis Lebanon. And Lebanon had a pair of fours, and we're sitting on a full house, and for some reason they won the pot. They won the gas. And I don't see that we're getting much of anything in return except for a statement that is not even UN-based, because Lebanon never agreed to it, a de facto status quo of a three-mile line that comes from the coast, that the second Hezbollah wants to change that and link it to the land border, it's worthless. So I don't know what that gives you, and I really don't know why our senior security people are so for it, other than saying, look, we got so many headaches on so many fronts, let's not deal with this one. You know, let's move on. We'll give them a few hundred million dollars in gas, and our economy can withstand it, and let's just give it up. But it's totally contrary to the way this negotiation went down for the last 10 years. And those people who say, well, this government got it done and you didn't get it done. Yeah, well, surrender is always an option. By the way, we can make a deal with, let's run back to the 67 lines tomorrow because it could avoid a potential war. And we could just sacrifice the assets and everyone will applaud us. And then when they go from those lines to attack us, all those same people will applaud us. When we defend ourselves from a worse position, they'll be the first ones to condemn us at the United Nations and elsewhere. It's what happened here to me. I just don't understand how it happened, why it happened, and why the security officials see this as being so beneficial to Israel. Something. I am missing something here, and I don't know what that is. It may exist, but I haven't seen it.
I agree with you that the central, well, the primary issue on this deal, and it's hard for me to judge all these details. It seems to me, as you point out, if instead of Israel agreeing to 100% of Lebanon's demands, if let's say it was a 60-40 split, you know, then maybe it won't, the perception might be different. Would you agree? Because actually, as you point out, the line I see that Lapid used is that this agreement, quote, staves off the possibility of a military clash with Hezbollah. He says, if we went to battle, we would deal them a heavy blow. That being said, if it is possible, if rent a war, it is a job of a responsible government to do so. I agree. I think the
if it's an agreement where you're not making a concession, then it's fine to do an agreement. Right. But it's like protection money.
Right. Well, that's what
you just paid people not to attack you. What is that? How far is Israel going to get with that?
Well, exactly. I think that line is to me damaging. It's a very poor way of describing this. It stays off war. It does. It could. It's reasonable to expect that Hezbollah did see that Israel was. Its primary concern was conflict aversion in a region where you certainly don't want that to be the perception. And at a time when, you know, Hezbollah has so many thousands of rockets, and it's very possible there might have to be a conflict, unfortunately, between Israel and Iran and its Hezbollah proxy. So to me, that is the biggest concern, it seems like to me.
Right. Look, I agree with you. There was a lot of criticism over the policy for many years of Netanyahu and his government to allow money to go into Gaza, okay? And they said, you know, you're paying protection money and you're allowing this money to flow into Gaza and you can't tell exactly where the money going and a lot of it is going to Hamas. And even though you try to do all these things to make sure it doesn't get diverted from Hamas, when there's also money is fungible. So if money is going to one place, then the military assistance that they're getting from Iran and from other places can go directly to fund their war machine. And that's a legitimate argument. Yeah. And the counter argument to that is, well, you know what? We got a lot of different fronts that we have to deal with. And it's better for us to have the more money go. Yes, they're going to get stronger. Yes, we're going to have a problem, but we're doing it with eyes wide open. And the difference is that policy can change at any minute. Here, you're making a permanent change to the border. Like, I would have been, for me, had Israel kept the line and not changed its maritime boundary line or economic waters, but actually have done the money, that would be better than what they did. They basically moved the line. Remember, we're going to have another issue also. This was a problem that we had with dealing with 1967. And the fact that it was understood in the Middle East that the Egyptians got 100% of their demands. And so therefore, all the other states now have to get 100% of their demands. And we've been digging ourselves out from under that for a long time. Even though that's not what UN Resolution 242 says, even the Land for Peace formulas, it's not to give back all the territory. Those of you who know are sensitive to these you know, 5 points of the language. But it's a problem. Now you're going to have other countries, other parties in the region, and the Lebanese will start mocking them. Why did you make that deal with Israel? Look what we got. We got 100%. We gave them nothing. We gave them no real recognition. We signed a couple of documents. They gave us all their gas. Why are you negotiating this? So they've actually made it harder for other Arab states to make peace with Israel because it's weak, bad negotiating from a weak position, instead of being in a very, very strong position. Now, what would have been the consequences? Let's take the logic to its extreme. Hezbollah's threatening, okay? Hezbollah, I think, is in a very weak position also internally in Lebanon. Israel could have said, here's a generous deal that we're prepared to offer you. If you go and attack us, we will respond extremely forcefully. We will knock it from the sky, and there's going to be a hell to pay. We would have held the line. Now, I think that Hezbollah will be deterred. Some people in Lebanon said Hezbollah basically succeeded at scaring Israel. But instead of holding that line and understanding the long-term consequences for Israel's national deterrence to buckle under the threats, and I 100% agree with you, what Lapid said of avoiding war is just about the worst language that you could say. He also said something else, which is interesting in that speech. He said that the reason why he wasn't going to bring it to the Knesset is that the opposition wasn't acting appropriately. You know, the opposition was reckless. Hefkerut, I think, was his word in Hebrew, which is basically they're not playing by the normal democratic norms or some ridiculous thing like that. Like, imagine if Netanyahu would have said, I'm not going to bring it to the Knesset because the opposition is not behaving. I mean, people would have went wild and said that this person is an authoritarian, a dictator, and has no respect for democratic rules. In the same speech, he both said something that is terrible for Israel's democracy and terrible for Israel's security by saying that, you know, we're going to do everything to avoid a war. Now, if somebody's making a peace agreement, there's making compromises, there's a quid pro quo, it's clear what we got from it beyond that, then you can come to the public and say, look, we're trying to reach peace. We're moving in a different direction. That's why I thought before I read the document that they would have at least gotten recognition of the boundary line. And they didn't get that recognition. Hezbollah made sure, I think, that Lebanon's government would not give it to them. And so I don't understand the answer to a simple question. What did Lebanon concede? What did they concede? They took Israel's gas, that's for sure. Now they can develop it. Now they're going to get a high share of the revenues, but they didn't make a single concession as far as I can see.
De facto, and I know the term recognition is not, maybe that's not the right word, but would you say a de facto recognition of this 3-mile buoy line, that was some progress for Israel?
Listen, until the Arab Spring, when things start to devolve a little bit in Syria, the safest border that we had was on the Golan, and they didn't recognize it. So what does it mean that you have a status quo? I mean, Israel has to defend itself, has to preserve its boundaries. The fact that now they're saying that's the status quo until we feel that it's not the status quo is recognition. I don't see it. Had they walked away with recognition, now we have a permanent border, and the Lebanese would have had to say to their people publicly, we have recognized the maritime boundary. We have land disputes with Israel. We still, you know, the Palestinian, whatever they want to say about that. But we've recognized the maritime boundary. It was a difficult decision for us to make, but we received something in return. Now we have a horizon for our economy. Now we're going to be able to develop the gas. People would look at it very differently. But now the leaders of Lebanon and Hezbollah can say, we gave up nothing. And they didn't give up anything. That is not a compromise. When they talk about, you know, the courage to actually make a deal, where is the courage on the where's the courage on the part of the Lebanese to do this deal? I don't see any of it.
Yeah, it seems like I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, it just
no, I just think that we sacrificed it. And I'm the reason why I'm pretty riled up about it is that I frankly don't understand it.
Why they needed to do it.
And if it's all political, it is hard for me to believe that if it is all political, that all the heads of all the security services will simply roll over and be full, you know, full-throated support for this. They may not oppose it. And there is some politicization that has happened over the years. Where I mentioned Oslo. I mentioned the disengagement where everybody lined up. But, you know, the director of al-Mossad, I think, has been very clear on his view of Iran, and he didn't go with the flow of the government. He has a different view, and I respect him, and I respect his view. So last time I said I want to reserve judgment until I've seen the deal. Now that I've seen the deal, I've actually more concerns than I had when we were speaking when it was theoretical, because I frankly do not get what Israel gets. I don't get it. And I see long-term consequences for this that are not bad. I also, you know, the argument that says that it weakens Iran or it's going to drive a wedge between Hezbollah and Iran, that to me sounds, you know, ridiculous, because the money's going to go to Lebanon. Hezbollah de facto is in control of that country. They're going to get their hands on it, which might be a price that we're willing to pay in order to get a recognized boundary. Fine. But we didn't get that. So how is this helping Israel's national security other than saying we've kicked the can down the road, but now the can that we're going to face is going to be much worse because our enemies now feel that Israel is not willing to fight. And that has long-term consequences for Israel. So one of the things I think that the new government is going to have to do is restore Israel's deterrence pretty fast on a lot of fronts. Now, Netanyahu never said, even though it was reported that, what I heard him say, and he chooses his words very carefully, he said the new government won't be obligated to the deal. He didn't say he's going to cancel it. He didn't say he's going to rip it up. And maybe, you know, maybe when he becomes prime minister and he understands all the calculations, I don't know what the Americans said. I don't know if there's other fronts that there's some sort of understanding with the United States. Because I can tell you, I gave you the story of Olmert because it's about 15 years old. About what happened in 2007. But I can assure you that there are many stories like this where a decision has been made. I saw it firsthand by Netanyahu that looks bad on one front, but it's because there is something that is far more important on another front. You remember a few years ago, just to give you an example that's, you know, publicly known, you remember when he didn't respond to a round of attacks. We didn't respond forcefully to a round of attacks from Hamas in Gaza. It was one of the mini rounds in between the big rounds. And he came under furious criticism. And the reason why he didn't respond is he made the decision that rather than responding more forcefully in Gaza at that point, what was more important was to take out the Hezbollah tunnel network that connects them to Israel. So he basically looked very bad on one front, calmed that one front down, then went and took care of the Hezbollah tunnels. So things like that can happen where if you take a step back and you say, what is in Israel's broader security interest, a decision that can at first make no sense all of a sudden makes sense. So that could be the case here. I just don't see it yet. You have to invite me, you know, when we have a future podcast, and it may take a year, it may take 5 years, it might take 10 years, we could look back at that moment and say, you remember when Israel agreed to that? Well, the reason Israel agreed to that was because of that. That was happening somewhere totally else. And our security chiefs knew that, which is possible.
I'd rather we have that kind of conversation than a different conversation the next year or so, where we say, remember when it looked like Israel was perceived as completely capitulating 100% to Lebanon's demand, that then emboldened Hezbollah to do certain things that it might not otherwise have been. And that seems to me the biggest concern for the deal was not maybe some of the particulars, was the perception of complete capitulation and this rhetoric by the Prime Minister Lapid that his main concern was averting war and not necessarily the merits of the agreement. And that is the fear. We'll see which the facts will bear out, which way we'll go.
The main concern of an Israeli prime minister, one of his main concerns should be to avert war.
Yeah.
It's just the way you avert war is by being strong.
Right.
It's not by actually looking weak and by capitulating to the threats. And that may require you to do smaller things, to be able to stand your ground and to go and to fight some blows. But when the bully, you know, he's not such a bully. I mean, Israel's the one that's the strong party here against Hezbollah, which, you know, is all due respect. It's the world's most powerful terror organization, but it doesn't come close to the power of a country like Israel. The way that you avert wars long term is by standing very strong against these types of threats. And I don't begrudge Lapid for wanting to avert war. It's just long term, our history shows that the way that you avert war is by becoming very, very powerful.
What I meant to say is, for instance, if there was a compromise of 60-40, I'm just using that as an example, and you use that rhetoric and say, look, the merits of the agreement are solid. It also averted war. Each side compromises, and we averted war, and that's a positive. That seemed to me a different message as opposed to agreeing 100% to the Lebanese demand and using language like that. That seems to be, to me, the risk for the Israeli government here.